I Hate the News is the weekly news bulletin from I Hate Politics podcast, a show about a human activity we love to hate. I'm Sunil Dasgupta. The week of September 24th, 2024. Last week, Maryland, Delaware, and Virginia beaches closed due to medical waste washing up ashore. They have now reopened, but who dumped garbage into the ocean? What is the effect of rent stabilization law on housing supply? A new paper has startling conclusions. Two-thirds of Maryland 18-year-olds are registered to vote, a report finds. Capital Bike Share, Washington area's public bike share service, shows sustained and dramatic growth. MCPS leans into choice and consortium programs to quell the bubbling dissatisfaction with the school district.
I Hate Politics is brought to you by UMBC's Political Science Program. If your goal is to make a meaningful impact with a career in local, state, or federal government, discover what this degree can do for you. Learn more at shadygrove.umbc.edu.
I Hate Politics is a podcast about our neighborhoods, workplaces, schools and streets, and our local governments as they function in diverse and democratic societies. This means our politics are messy, dirty, sometimes corrupt, with often self-serving politicians. But no matter how much we may hate politics, we are never exempt from it, even when we refuse to participate. In fact, the purpose of politics is to keep society functioning precisely when we don't agree with each other, like now. Music for this episode comes from Washington, D.C. area post-punk rock band Gray Swift. Mike Mangiaracina on guitar and vocals, Fabrizio Cariani on guitar and backing vocals, Evan Hurd on bass, and Chris Blackburn on the drums. The songs come from their album, Closure Ends. Last Sunday, September 15th, medical waste and other plastic trash began to wash ashore on Atlantic Ocean beaches from Delaware to Virginia. Ocean City, Maryland, the town of Fenwick, Assateague State Park, and Assateague National Seashore, and others all closed their beaches. On Friday, September 20th, the town of Ocean City issued a statement announcing their reopening. After multiple high tides and several days of beach sweeping, we are no longer experiencing waste washing ashore. Ocean City Emergency Services, in collaboration with the Worcester County Health Department and environmental programs, has conducted thorough water testing, and the results show the water is within normal limits. We are confident that it is now safe to reopen the ocean for swimming and surfing. Similarly, Fenwick Island and the Assateague National and State Parks have also cleaned up their sections of the beach and reopened. But no one seems to know where the debris came from. In an official statement, the Maryland Emergency Management Administration, the agency coordinating local, state, and federal authorities, have said that federal officials will decide whether an official investigation is warranted, but did not provide any standard for what would warrant an investigation. The department has said that they lack legal authority to perform the investigation themselves, nor are they equipped with tools to conduct such an investigation. We will be following up on the story and have asked Maryland Secretary of Emergency Management, Russell Strickland, for a formal interview. Stay tuned. A couple of weeks ago, we reported that a new paper from the DC-based Urban Institute made a startling claim that while rent stabilization law depresses housing supply overall, as any price cap is supposed to do, at the lowest income level, at 30% of area median income, the paper said supply actually increased. I asked one of the co-authors of the paper, Tina Stacy, of the Urban Institute, why this should be.
We can really only speculate on the mechanisms, unfortunately. I mean, overall supply is clear, right? Well, even if it's new units aren't subject to it, there might be complete teardowns through which landlords can get out of rent control through substantial renovations, pass-throughs. We know when new units are built, they're invariably going to be more expensive, right? Because they're new. But, you know, why we're seeing an increase at the bottom end is not completely clear. Like I mentioned, it could reflect quality issues. There could be some, there is some research that suggests that rent control incentivizes a reduction in quality, housing quality, which might lead to that. Or, you know, again, this is where we need better research to know who's occupying those units, because there could be some kind of filtering where when there's not enough supply, people who would otherwise be in higher cost units end up occupying units below them. So, I mean, that doesn't, again, it doesn't really tell you much about why we're seeing that increase at the low end, other than hopefully it is doing what organizers would tell you they'd like it to do, which is helping to prevent displacement and allow for people with lower incomes to remain in areas that are growing quickly.
As housing affordability emerges as a leading political issue, advocates have debated the best way to get to the goal. On the one hand, supply enthusiasts contend that housing shortage must be mitigated for housing costs to stabilize. But on the other hand, rent control activists believe that price caps on rent are now necessary to keep people in places where they live. The trouble is that those who build housing don't like price caps. Actual rent law differs from jurisdiction to jurisdiction on what the threshold price cap should be, whether or not to exempt new buildings and big renovations. But as Josh Woolridge of the Nationwide Affordable Housing Building Company, NRP Group, said on this show a couple of weeks ago, the rent law must exempt new construction indefinitely for it not to affect supply. Most supply advocates see rent control as making the root cause worse. But rent law activists see an immediate need that has to be addressed now and not to wait for supply to catch up. I'll make a mea culpa here. Several years ago, I had thought supply activists and rent control activists would arrive at a grand bargain. Rent stabilization for those at the lowest income level, and in return, a massive upzoning that increased the supply of land available for multifamily buildings, which housed more people than single-family homes. I was wrong. No such coalition exists. Developers who build homes care more about rent laws killing their projects. Supply enthusiasts generally do not see any good in rent control laws. On the other hand, rent law advocates don't trust the market enough to be confident that supply would increase if it were allowed, and that the expected increase would actually stabilize the market sufficiently to help the lowest income residents. In fact, the rancor between rent law advocates and supply advocates appears to be worse than it is with those who want no more housing and certainly no more affordable housing in their neighborhoods. A new report from the University of Maryland's Center for Democracy and Civic Engagement has found that 2/3 of all 18-year-olds in Maryland are registered to vote. Registration, turnout, and political participation among young people is a key variable in electoral prospects as well as the health of democracy. Here is Sam Novy, one of the authors of the report and the chief strategist for the Center for Democracy and Civic Engagement.
The good news is that 18-year-olds who are eligible to vote already, we have 64% of those new voters who are registered. And we have over 1/3 of eligible Maryland 16 and 17-year-olds using pre-registration. The law to register 16, 17-year-olds was passed in 2010. So we've had this law longer than many other states. The Civic Center, who we partnered with on this report, they did an analysis in 2019 that showed that 35% of eligible 16 and 17 year olds were registered. So that number has actually dropped a little bit, which is concerning, and suggests that other reforms are going to be necessary. Maryland is doing better than New York, better than California, which have, you know, we're slower in adopting pre-registration, but, you know, other states like Massachusetts, Colorado in particular, which has upgraded their automatic voter registration system, they are seeing much higher rates of 16 and 17 year olds using pre-registration. Right now, you still need to opt in at MVA. And so that does lead to lower rates than we see in places like Colorado, where they've upgraded to a secure automatic voter registration system. When you got your driver's license, you also were registered to vote. If you would like to not register to vote, here's how you would opt out.
Okay, so they have an opt out and Maryland has an opt in. What do you think will bring that last one third in?
Setting up that kind of relationship with schools would be a worthwhile thing to explore. There's voter education in schools, but if the schools know that you are an eligible voter, that information is not transmitted to the State Board of Elections. So that would be, obviously that would be challenging to administer, but that would be a very powerful way to serve people more equitably.
Sam Novy, thank you for taking the time. Good luck in this effort.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks so much for having me on, Sunil. I appreciate it.
The Capital Bike Share, the publicly owned micromobility company, it seems has been growing by leaps and bounds. Samuel Litauer follows bike share trends and writes about them on the Greater Washington blog.
Over the past year and beyond, Capital Bike Share has experienced a real surge in ridership post-pandemic and continues to break records all across the region. Across the DMV, Capital Bike Share is now on track to break its all-time ridership record. Well, hold on. I'm going to shift gears a little bit. Capital Bike Share ridership is absolutely surging. For the past 32 months, it has broken its year-over-year monthly ridership record. For the past 4 months in particular, it's broken its all-time record for the busiest month on record. Just this past month, there were about 614,000 rides on Capital Bike Share across the DMV. That was the busiest month of all time in August 2024. Before that, it was about 585,000 rides. Before that, 580. But if you look back a year ago, you know, Capital Bike Share ridership is up 31% year over year and has maintained that growth for the past about 3 years, ever since the pandemic.
What was it before the pandemic?
Well, Capital Bike Share is a pretty old system. It's one of the first, public subsidized ridership systems in the country. It was started in September of 2010. It's about to turn 14 years old. Ridership had been consistently increasing up until 2019. It was averaging in, the upper 300,000 rides per month. And service was doing really well. Of course, in 2020, once the pandemic came along, not just Capital Bike Share, but every major transit service took a huge hit. Cabby, as people call it here in DC, was no different. Ridership slowed down drastically. But Capital Bike Share made this really strategic decision to expand even while ridership was low in 2021, adding, countless stations to the system, increasing the bike total to what it is now, to about 7,000 bikes and a little over 790 stations across the DMV. So it's proven really effective, that shift in investment to expanding the system, even when ridership is low, made a huge difference for getting, overall trip totals to where it is today.
This growth is particularly striking when you consider that other transit modes, trains, buses, have not grown this dramatically.
Well, WMATA service has increased quite significantly. It's doing really well, I would argue. But Metro Rail is not quite back to where it was pre-pandemic in terms of its overall ridership. Metro Bus, I will add, is ahead of where it was pre-pandemic, which is great news. Capital bike share, on the other hand, though, has not just, you know, increased where it was pre-pandemic, it's nearly doubled its overall annual ridership. Nationwide, there is a culture that wants to shift away from car dependency and towards more multimodal options.
What about other bike share companies in DC itself?
There are four other micro-mobility companies that are allowed to operate in DC. This includes VO, Spin, which has both scooters and bikes. It includes Lyft, which offers a whole separate fleet of electric scooters. And then it has Lime. And Lime itself also has been posting record ridership for months on end. Just this past month, they bordered 700,000 monthly rides across its electric scooter and e-bike fleet.
Can you speak to how the fleets are changing?
The fleet is certainly becoming more electric. You see increased stations, not just in DC, but across the greater DMV, or Northern Virginia is adding a dozen or so stations. But not all stations are producing the same utility or utilization of ridership. If you look at Montgomery County, they just removed about 10 stations from their network.
Why the difference?
DC and Northern Virginia, while there still is a lot of work to do in creating more connected, protected bike corridors, they are leading the way in the region. About 86% of all rides this past month across the entire Capital Bike Share system were in DC. 86%. But DC only has about 45% of the stations. So to me, that shows that when you provide a sizable fleet for people to get around, and add on top of it safe options for people to get between where they need to go for the first and final mile of their transportation, the ridership will come.
You said Montgomery County is removing stations, right?
That's correct.
So they built it there and it didn't come.
It feels to me as if it's a joint equation where you both need to have the infrastructure to support increased ridership and the equipment. You need the equipment of stations of bikes, which Montgomery County had. If they weren't leading the way and not just providing the equipment, but also the infrastructure that creates for more safe modes of transportation, then I would say that's of no surprise to me that ridership did not increase in the same way that it did in DC.
Samuel Litauer, thank you for taking the time.
Thank you for having me, Sunil.
MCPS, it seems, is leaning toward more school choice for students. The Down County Consortium, which has long existed, allows students in the Silver Spring area to choose between schools by selecting a specialist program, the Communications Arts Program at Blair High School, or the Visual Arts Program at Einstein High School, or the Leadership Program at Kennedy High School. Now the consortium approach is spreading. MCPS is undertaking outreach to 8th grade families with information about a leadership academy at Walt Whitman High School, an agriculture science program at Sherwood High School, the vocation education programs at Edison, which have been around for quite some time. These programs are now available to high school clusters more widely in the county. In public education, the federal government requires that all states test their K-12 students for progress. In Maryland, this takes the form of the Maryland Comprehensive Assessment Program, MCAP, which released its 2023-24 scorecard at the end of August. The top line is that there is some improvement in English language and math, but losses in science. The whole issue of learning loss has been vexing since the pandemic and in many jurisdictions. The difficulties with assessment and test scores have fueled right-wing candidates running for school boards. Nothing, it seems, is working according to these complaints. But the truth lies in understanding what these test scores are and what they are, in fact, measuring. Take math. The test scores range from Math 3, which is supposed to be taken in third grade, to Math 8, which is to be taken in eighth grade by students who are in fact behind. There are separate scores for Algebra 1, which can be taken by a student as early as 6th grade, depending on ability, or in 9th or 10th grade. But if a student is taking Algebra 1 in 9th or 10th grade, they are already behind in math. So 6th graders taking Algebra 1 have a proficiency rate of 93%. 9th graders taking Algebra 1 have a lower proficiency level. The same can be argued for Geometry and Algebra 2. In contrast, the English language test scores are gently upward sloping from 3rd grade to 10th grade. The numbers are still low, 55% in 10th grade, but you can see that more students are hitting the mark as they go through the years of school. What happens to the other 45%? A big chunk of these students tend to have disabilities. Only 14% of students with disabilities meet the proficiency level in English. Non-English speaking immigrant students joining schools in middle and high tend to be behind as well. The fall off this year in science scores is somewhat inexplicable, maybe just to me, and I need to find out more. But what is mind-boggling to me, at least, is that MCAP requires social studies tests in 8th grade and in high school, and yet no social studies test scores are reported. It is unclear if the state is mandating testing in different areas in a phased manner, and social studies has not come up yet, but it breaks my heart that social studies is last. As of this recording, I have not found out why this is the case, but I hold out the hope of learning more. When I do, I will share here. That's all for this episode. Be sure to check out our feature interview series that comes out Friday mornings. I Hate Politics is produced by me, Sunil Dasgupta, and assistant producer, Adama Gay, with support from the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. I direct UMBC's political science program at the universities at Shady Grove in Montgomery County, where, among other things, we explore and learn about politics, government, and society close to home. Music for this episode comes from Washington, D.C. area post-punk rock band Gray Swift. Mike Mangiaricino on guitar and vocals. Fabrizio Cariani on guitar and backing vocals. Evan Hurd on bass. And Chris Blackburn on the drums. The songs come from their album, Closure Ends.